morning, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 221 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We have a bit of a smaller show, but not a shorter show, just two segments this week. And we're going to switch things up a little bit with the order of the show. So first up, we have our pal Steve Saipa answering an email about one of the Mets' top prospects.
Hey Mets fans, it's Steve Saipa here, and I am here to answer an email. So, Ryan Mulner asks, where do you guys stand on Thomas Zubocki? I know he was very impressive last year, albeit in limited action. Is he the clear-cut number one pitching prospect in the system now, or is it too early to tell? So, Ryan, who is the Mets' best pitching prospect? It is not Thomas Zubocki, in my personal opinion. That honor goes to none other than Rob Gesellman, who was ranked second best prospect in 2017 by Mason Avenue, and the Mets' top-ranked pitching prospect, as we saw in his cup of coffee last year in the major leagues. His fastball sits, you know, low to mid-90s. It has touched once as high as 98, but really the pitch maxes at about 96 miles per hour, and it gets a lot of sink, so he has a very good ground ball rate. His curveball, it's an above-average plus pitch. His slider, which he really just started throwing this year, is already an above-average, you know, plus pitch. So that's two, you know, above-average to plus pitches that he throws. And then a changeup, which lags well behind the other two. But given that he has, you know, a decent selection with his curveball and slider, he doesn't need to go to the changeup as often as, you know, he might. So it's not that big of a knock against him. Really, Gesellman should be, you know, realistically, he should be in the top third of most top 100 prospect lists. I mean, think about the right-handed pitchers that are in, you know, the farm systems of Major League Baseball teams today. I think you have an elite of, you know, Tyler Glasnow, Lucas Giolito, Alex Reyes, Anderson Espinosa, Francis Martes. But after that, I mean, Gesellman is pretty, you know, he compares pretty favorably to the next couple of guys that would still be on the board. If you look at the scouting reports and numbers of guys like Jeff Hoffman on the Rockies, Jose De Leon on the Dodgers, Robert Stevenson on the Reds, Brent Honeywell from the Rays, you know, a couple guys. They're all, you know, top 20, 30 prospects in baseball. And Gesellman, you know, he compares pretty favorably to them with the stuff and the numbers, the results, everything. So realistically, Gesellman should be, you know, a top 20, 30 prospect in baseball. So it's hard to, you know, getting back to Zubocki, it's hard, you know, to outshine, you know, a top 20, 30 prospect in baseball, in my, you know, personal opinion. And when top 100 lists start getting revealed, there might be certain lists that have Robert Gesellman ranked very high. So looking at Zubocki and, ignoring Gesellman, we've got Thomas Zubocki. He was the clear standout. And Justin Dunn, who I would say is the other clear standout. You know, the two pitchers that are at the top of most, if not all, Mets prospect lists. So let's take a look at the two of those guys. They're a little similar. So let's look at them and see if we can, you know, suss out who is the better pitcher right now. Fastballs. So Pucky throws a fastball, sits 92-95, tops out at 97. And he gets good movement thanks to his arm slot, which is kind of somewhere between a low three-quarters angle and, you know, three-quarter arm slot. Dunn also throws a fastball that sits 92-95, tops at 97, and he gets some pretty good arm side run on it. So I would say that if you're comparing the two, they're about even in terms of their fastballs. So now we'll look at the secondary stuff. Zubocki throws a sweeping curveball that sits about 75 to 80 miles an hour. It's about an average pitch right now. Flashes plus when he's really got it going. And he throws a changeup that's thrown in the low 80s, and it's not a good pitch, really. It's still developing. But over the course of the summer, he really improved it, especially against right-handers, thanks to some coaching he got early in the year from Ron Romanek. So this time next year, if the changeup continues improving like it did last year, the pitch could be, you know, fringe average, maybe even an average pitch if it really improves, and we're bullish about that. So now we'll look at Dunn. Dunn throws a tight slider in the mid-80s that it's an average pitch now and flashes plus. He throws a fringy curveball, fringe average curveball. It sits also in the mid-80s, and it's really just a little slower and loopier than the slider. And he also has a changeup, but he really doesn't go to it much. You know, there's not really that much of a differential in its speed between it and his fastball. It's really right now still in the mid to high 80s, and it doesn't really have much movement to it, so it's, you know, also a developing pitch. So with their secondaries, I'm going to give Zupacki this edge, really, because of his changeup. Dunn has an extra pitch with his curveball, but it really isn't an effective pitch. You know, it and the slider sometimes kind of bleed together to the point where you really can't even tell if his slider is just a little loopy or if he's, you know, intentionally throwing the curve. Zupacki, you know, he put in work with his changeup, and even though it's still a developing pitch, you really, you know, it really got a lot better as the summer progressed. So he gets the edge. Zupacki gets the edge there. And now let's just kind of look at some miscellaneous things. Zupacki had his season end prematurely due to some lower back issues. That's not a good thing. That could be a pretty big red flag, but could is the key word. Being shut down early could really just be more precautionary than real, but, you know, we don't know. So it's something to be aware of that could have a pretty big impact on him in the future. Zupacki's a lot more raw than Dunn is also, even though Dunn is pretty raw as a starter himself. He has the throwing the ball part down, but he still needs to work on a lot of the stuff, like working out of the stretch, pitching, you know, inside the hitters, you know, fielding his position. So, I mean, there's work. There's always work to be done. Dunn had major issues holding his velocity. I know I've mentioned this before, but, you know, I watched Dunn's fastball velocity go from a steady low to mid 90s to the next inning low 90s to the next inning high 80s and low 90s right before my eyes. You know, two starts, in one in August, one in late August, and the other in early September against Staten Island. So the lack of stamina might just be because, you know, he's a reliever for most of his career, and the 30 innings that he threw at Brooklyn coupled with the 65 that he threw at Boston College, they're almost double the amount that he threw as a sophomore in 2015. So, you know, that could be the culprit. Or it could be that, you know, his frame, which is, you know, he's 6'2", 185. So, you know, he's built, but, you know, not that heavy. You know, he's kind of slim. It could be that his frame maybe can't support premium velocity for more than an inning or so. You know, I don't know. But we'll find out next season, I guess. So, overall, Zupacki gets the edge, which is why he was ranked the third best prospect, you know, by Mason Avenue, and Dunn was ranked eighth. Me, personally, I ranked Zupacki fourth on my list, and Dunn seventh. So, there you have it, Ryan. I hope I answered your question satisfactorily. And, you know, anyone else has any other prospect questions, please email us, because it's the middle of the winter and not much is going on. So, thanks a lot, everyone. This is Steve Saipa, and I'll talk to you guys.
Well, Chris, we are fresh off of actually hanging out in person, getting a rare in-person hangout at the Nelson Figueroa charity bowling event on Monday night, where we had a nice time. We got to speak with Nelson and Jim Duquette and John Franco, hopefully all three of whom will appear on the podcast at some point. That'll be fun.
Yeah, that would be nice.
And but we got a listener email this week, and so as always, you can email the show podcast at amazingavenueaudio.com. And Brad asks us, with the Philadelphia acquisition of Michael Saunders for a one-year signing, this almost certainly takes them out of the potential Bruce deal. I'm not too sure I see too many teams out there looking at him. My prediction is they keep him on the roster. What role do you see him on this team? What are the probabilities of a release by the end of the season? How bad of a trade does this look like in even such a short-term look? All right, there's a lot to unpack there. Let's first talk about how bad does this trade look. We won't really know that until we figure out how good of a player Dilson Herrera is going to be.
Right.
You know, and I know that that's such a cop-out answer to say, you know, that you don't really, it takes, you know, a number of years to see how bad a trade is, but that's the truth. If Herrera winds up being a fringy prospect who has a little bit of time with the majors, doesn't really hit, doesn't play great defense, then the trade isn't that terrible. If he's anything close to a major league regular, this is a, and Bruce is on the roster this year and is as ineffective as he was for the most, for the majority of his Mets tenure, then this is a terrible trade in a franchise that's had a number of terrible trades. But I think that, that implies a lot of things, and I don't know if I would necessarily imply any of those things at this point. I guess the big question we should sort of start with here, Chris, is what do you think, if Bruce is on the team as of opening day, do you see him as anything but their starting left or right fielder?
No, I would say, you know, with Cespedes cemented in left, I would say he's the starting right fielder going into the season. And, you know, I know that I've been saying that wouldn't be the end of the world. It wouldn't doom the 2017 Mets season. You know, it's not it's not ideal. It's not my preferred option. You know, Michael Conforto obviously has a lot of supporters. He showed us what kind of hitter he could be when he first came up to the big leagues. You know, there's plenty of reasons that it's preferable to have Conforto playing every day. But given the construction of the roster, if they take Bruce all the way to opening day, and this may be an unpopular opinion, but I'd be inclined to have Conforto play in Vegas until Bruce did something, you know, until Bruce was either good enough that a team wanted to trade for him, or, you know, something came up, somebody got hurt, and there was a spot to bring him up. And that's not, you know, I think I've been consistent in saying that I generally root for the players when it comes to salary and that sort of thing. But if I'm, you know, looking at it from the team perspective, if Bruce is around, I think Terry Collins is probably going to end up playing him a lot. And under those circumstances, I think it's probably more beneficial that Conforto at least hits and plays baseball every day. And, you know, the side benefit of that for the team is that it, you know, could prevent him from earning service time and keep him under control longer. Now, you know, that concept is something that should be out the window, generally speaking. But if he's only going to be on the bench and start once or twice a week, you know, how much difference does it make if he's there or if Brandon Nimmo's there?
I mean, I agree with you completely. And I think anybody who is going to fight that point is not thinking about this realistically, right? Like, nobody, I don't think anybody within the organization, nor do I think anybody, not anybody, I think most diehard Mets fans would rather see Conforto to at least give him a shot before, you know, giving the reins to Bruce. But I think if you're being realistic about this, Conforto playing every day is more important than almost anything else related to Bruce. If Conforto is going to be the long-term solution in the outfield, then you have to let him play more than 3 days a week. It's the way it has to be. And on the Major League roster, with Granderson, Bruce, and Cespedes, he's not going to play more than 2 or 3 days a week. So I'm with you on that one. I also think that to ask Terry Collins to not play a veteran is like asking a tiger to change its stripes. You know, it's just who Collins is as a manager. So I think no matter what, he's going to get playing time. He's going to get a lot of playing time if he's around. You know, a couple of good things could happen. If Bruce was really in just a funk for his beginning of his Mets tenure, well, that means that you could get a player who is far better than we saw last year to be playing for the Mets. And that's a good thing. A player with some power, a player who could potentially help the Mets early on in the season. You know, this is not going to be easy for the Mets to win the division. So any offensive help they can get early in the season is a really, really nice thing. So, you know, Bruce could have some residual benefit from being there. I don't think it's enough to stop trying to trade him. I think the trading him should still be the priority here. But I think we're getting to the point in the offseason where it no longer necessarily makes sense to trade Bruce for a bag of balls.
Yeah, that could be the case. And, you know, going into one of the other specifics of the question, the probability of a release by the end of the season, I mean, I wouldn't say that's impossible. I would bet that it's unlikely. I would bet against that happening. You know, what he did in the two seasons before his great first half that preceded the trade to the Mets was concerning. It wasn't good, you know, just from a hitting perspective. You know, if you buy that his defense is so bad that it erases even, you know, good to great power hitting, as was the case in his time with Cincinnati in 2016, you know, then that's a guy who you might release. I'm not necessarily saying that I don't buy that. It's just
that's a bold step to take.
Yeah, I don't think he ends up being so bad that that happens. I could be wrong, but my guess is that Jay Bruce remains on a major league roster, you know, through the end of the 2017 season.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that people might be forgetting how many injuries happened during spring training. And, you know, there is a team out there who's probably going to need a left-handed bat before the end of spring training. And we might be getting past the point here where the return for Bruce is going to be exciting. But, well, I guess let's ask this question, Chris. At this point in the offseason, what is an acceptable return?
I mean, I think I came into this thinking salary relief.
But I don't think that's even going to happen anymore. I mean, yeah, they're going to have to eat some of it.
Yeah, I would gladly take a third or half of it and get two marginal minor leaguers. You know, we saw that the latest rumor on it was that the Mets were asking teams for two prospects. Now, prospect is a term that can be thrown around to mean pretty much anybody who's a minor league baseball player. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're not looking at getting some organization's top guy or two. But right. If you can get two marginal guys and you pay, you know, $5 or $6 million, you get those guys, you're essentially just buying some minor league depth. At that point, you know, you do that, hopefully reinvest whatever's left over in a relief pitcher, maybe two, you know, I a few guys have come off the board. It's still amazing that there are quite a few of major league caliber relievers that are still out there.
Including one Jerry Blevins.
Yep. He's still out there. My, my free agent sort of, fit, especially if he's down to a situation where, you know, he has to take something resembling a flyer, would be Sergio Romo. He's still out there. You know, there's a lot of guys left out there. So I don't know that that necessarily means that they'll all be bargains, but
it's looking more likely that Romo's a bargain than earlier this offseason, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, if that's the case and you can sign two guys with whatever, you know, Bruce money. And to be clear, I think I would hope you would do that even if you don't get rid of Bruce, but eating half of Bruce's salary just to bring in another few guys who help you at different levels of the organization, I think would be very well worth it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Anything else to say about Bruce, or we pretty much covered him?
No, I look forward to continuing Bruce Avenue audio.
I was just going to make the same joke.
Bruce Boulevard, maybe?
Bruce Boulevard works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go with Bruce Boulevard. I like that. all right. Well, you know, there is still one little bit of Mets news that we haven't covered that is relevant to the 2017 season, which is that Wilmer Flores and the Mets did not yet reach an agreement on Flores' salary for next year. He's the only player since 2008 with Oliver Perez to go to arbitration with the Mets. Chris, you have the numbers memorized because, of course, you do. What are the numbers on both sides here for the contract?
So Flores submitted $2.2 million, and the Mets submitted $1.8 million. In the grand scheme of things, in the world of Major League Baseball in 2017, that's nothing.
Yeah, but it's the Mets, so it's a little bit more than nothing.
Yeah, no, it is, but it's just, it's not a big deal, you know, and I didn't see anybody who really read into it that it was.
Right, this isn't going to be the kind of arbitration that ends with the team and the player hating each other.
No, but it did seem, it's a little odd, like.
Yeah.
You couldn't just meet it too?
You know? Especially as I would think that the team would recognize how valuable Flores is as a as sort of an avatar for this team, you know, his heroics at the end of the 2015 season are going to make him a member of Mets lore forever. This is a player that not only has value on the field, but has a substantial amount of value off the field. For, you know, $400,000, it seems like that's something that the average major league team should be able to eat with no questions asked.
Right. And I get that they, you know, they always try to keep the raises minimal so that the next one, you know, there's a sort of cumulative effect,
right,
of each one. So I understand that, but, you know, it's just, it, like, whatever. He's Wilmer Flores. You know, he's not going to play enough to rack up numbers that are going to get a major.
Exactly, yeah. Look, if Flores is due a giant raise next year because he had the most monster season possible, that's a great problem to have.
Right, and I don't think the difference between any of the numbers, or those two numbers now at this point, because, you know, the arbitrator picks one of the two. There's not, you know, there's not a made up compromise or anything in between. Somebody wins, somebody loses. And I'm not sure of the percentage of times the teams win or lose. And it, you know, it probably has a lot to do with how much of a gap there is and if somebody's being outlandish on one side or the other. In this case, neither side is. I'm guessing it's a 50-50 shot. You know, so it's a 50% chance of saving less than one player who makes the league minimum.
Right, yeah. It's not like this is what's going to prevent the Mets from going out and getting Jerry Blevins.
No. I certainly hope not.
Yeah.
Jerry, we've got a deal ready. Oh, we just got to win this case versus Wilmer Flores.
I mean, to be fair, weirder Mets things have happened than that.
True. But yeah, no, I think we are I think we're past that, and I'll say that the Cespedes signing alone should at least give them the benefit of the doubt on, you know, how they're approaching Jerry Blevins.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, that brings us to a little bit of, I don't know if you call it sad news. It certainly isn't happy news, but former Met pitcher Jeremy Hefner has announced his retirement. Now, Jeremy Hefner has a very special place in my heart. Jeremy Hefner was, what was the year he had that halfway decent season? Is that 2013?
Was it 13 or 14? Baseball Reference will tell us. 13 was halfway decent.
Okay.
He was 12 and 13. He was in the majors. And, yeah, 2013, 130 and two-thirds innings, 4.34 ERA, which isn't great, but,
He became, to me, the avatar of my broken Mets fandom. Because I remember, like, you know, putting together serious thought into my AAOP with ways to keep Hefner on the team. Like, you know, because at that point, you know, being a Mets fan was just a slog in a lot of ways. And he seemed at the time like maybe there'd be something there. Looking back on it now, he was never going to be the savior of anything. And that's not a knock on Jerry Blevins. Jerry Blevins is 400% more of an athlete than I will ever be.
Jeremy Hefner.
I'm sorry, Jeremy Hefner. My apologies.
No. I almost said it wrong in correcting.
Yeah. but yeah,
they really do blend together.
They really do. But you know, Hefner is, you know, he's 5 times, 10 times the athlete I am. Even if he never gets off his couch again, you know. But he was sort of this character right before the Mets got good again, where there was all this hope in Harvey and Syndergaard and Wheeler, and we knew we had to kind of suffer through guys like Hefner for another year or two to get ready for it to be really good. But me personally, I think a lot of Mets fans weren't content to just write off those teams. We were still rooting hard. We were still wanting the team to find those hidden gems, those diamonds in the rough, however you want to put it. And so I'll always have a bit of a positive place in my heart for Hefner, even though, you know, he certainly is not my favorite Met, nor would he be in the top, you know, 100 most consequential Mets of the past decade.
Right, no, but there's I think I'm about to tweet it out as we record, but you can go back, and I think one of the best Mets gifts that's ever been out there was
the new Hefner one
when he was being interviewed by Kevin Burkhardt in the dugout.
Yeah,
and Kirk Nieuwenhuis, you know, came up out of nowhere, and like everybody in the shot behind them was participating. You know, I think LaTroy Hawkins looked like he was swimming. Several other guys on the team were doing, you know, just funny things. But Nieuwenhuis comes up with like his eyes wide open, like big bug-eyed look out of nowhere, right in the middle of the shot. And Hefner keeps his composure. And so does Kevin Burkhardt, for that matter.
Yeah.
But it just made for this really great visual, you know, a great SNY moment that I remember some of the things he did on the mound, but that's going to be my lasting memory, and that's not an insult because it was amazing.
Yeah. I'd be happy to contribute anything in my life as memorable as that image. So fare thee well, Jeremy Hefner. I'm sorry I fucked up your name before. And that brings us to our penultimate topic of the night. The Mets this week announced the designs for their Free Shirt Friday events. There are two or three Free Shirt Fridays each month, with June getting three, the rest of the months getting two. One of the selections this year is a long sleeve shirt. And we get shirts dedicated to, let's see if I can do all these, Reyes, Syndergaard, Walker and Cabrera together, DeGrom, Cespedes. Is that it? Is there anybody else that gets their own solo shirt, or are those all of them?
Let's take a look. You know, I'm just saying, if I were promoting my t-shirts, I'd have the images be a little bit bigger than a, like a thumbnail.
I agree.
But yeah, player specific, I think that's everybody.
And then you get a couple, there's a nice shirt that says, the opening weekend shirt says there's no place like, and then there's a home plate with the Mets logo on it. There's a tie-dye Mets shirt, which probably will be tied in somewhere to the Dead & Company show happening at Citi Field.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of just, you know, generic Mets designs. Although I have to say, some of those generic designs, specifically the August 18th one and the July 21st one, seem pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's... I think of the whole bunch, the May 5th Syndergaard is the one that stands out to me.
Yeah.
That might just be my... You know... It might be how I think of Syndergaard generally.
No, I agree, but it has a nice thunderbolt to it. It's
yeah.
That's the nicest shirt of the bunch, for sure.
Yeah, but, you know, as far as promos go, you know, not to sound like we're selling tickets for the Mets here, but as far as promos go, they do a pretty decent job with this, and I think it's a pretty good batch of shirts.
Yeah, I mentioned before.
My one thing with, go ahead.
No, you go first.
Okay, so my one thing with it is a request similar to the one that Jerry gave to George. I'm not necessarily saying have all the sizes, but every shirt's an extra large that they give out, so that you know, it falls into the one size fits most.
Right.
In the sense that. It could be either big or really big on a lot of people,
yeah,
and properly fit a lot of people. But maybe just like two options, you know, yeah. Like go to the left if you want, you know, size A,
right,
and to the
right
for B. Just, you know, just some distinction, I think. And then in the end, if people get shirts that don't fit them, whatever. But just two different sizes. That's all.
I understand that request. As an extra large, I don't care. Screw y'all.
Yeah, no,
but,
yes.
I'm kidding. But what I was going to say is I also like the DeGrom shirt, which has him, it just has like a hand gripping a baseball. And I can't really see what's behind the image. I think it's his hair.
Oh, yeah, that's his hair.
And that is actually on my birthday, so I will probably be at that game. So I will gladly collect at that game anyone's ill-fitting shirts they don't want.
Yes.
I will adorn my wardrobe with as many DeGrom shirts as I can. And yeah, because why not, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure how they pull this off next year, but they've done the DeGrom hair hat. Now there's a DeGrom hair shirt. there somehow has to be a pair of DeGrom hair pants.
Oh,
I have no idea how that works, but, you know, you got to complete the...
The DeGrom hair outfit.
Maybe you just make it like the pinstripe Mets pants with, instead of like the 86 Mets racing stripe.
Just hair stripes?
Yeah, just DeGrom, you know, DeGrom hair.
Hair pants, not just for serial killers anymore. Oh, boy. All right. Well, the last item on our agenda tonight is the big news of the week in baseball, which is that the Baseball Hall of Fame has a few new members. We got Jeff Bagwell, Tim Raines, and Pudge Rodriguez as the newest members of the Hall of Fame. What are your initial thoughts on the class of 2017, Chris?
Well, I'm thrilled. So Jeff Bagwell was always my favorite non-Met. And, you know, for like a little bit of a backstory there, the AA team in New Britain, Connecticut, well, they've theoretically moved to Hartford, although they haven't played a game there yet, as the, and I love this name, but I would say infamous Yard Goats.
Yep.
It's an accurate phrase. Before they were the Yard Goats, they were the New Britain Rockettes, a Twins affiliate. But before that, they were the New Britain Red Sox, the AA affiliate of, obviously, the Boston Red Sox. So that was where I saw a lot of games growing up in Connecticut. And we went, you know, Bagwell was there. I was 6 years old at the time. So Bagwell, you know, he's there in 1990. He was also a Connecticut kid. He grew up, went to high school, and went to college all within the state. And I remember we were sitting there, and New Britain had a new stadium built in the mid-90s that was, you know, really nice, big upgrade from where they used to play at a park called Beehive Field. So Beehive was – it wasn't a dump or anything. It just more resembled like maybe an American Legion style.
Okay.
Place to see a game, you know, more GA benches style seating than your normal minor league park would have now. It still exists, but that's where I first saw Jeff Bagwell. So I'm 6, he was 22, looking at it now. And I remember there was a game that we're sitting there, and my dad's chatting with a guy, and it turns out that it's Bagwell's dad.
Oh, wow.
You know, and they're just chatting throughout the game and whatever. But I remember Bagwell's dad saying at the time that they were thrilled and, you know, just to be able to watch him play pro ball. And, you know, even if this is as far as he gets, it's great and whatever, you know, things along those lines. You know, so he was a New Britain guy to me who, you know, I went and saw. I'm sure I got his autograph back then. I mean, I was 6, so... You know, I was still very much in autograph mode. And, you know, I remember him playing. He played third base when he was there, too. The Astros moved him over to first after they got him in the trade. But, you know, to go from that. So, you know, there was that very direct connection of this guy. And then he goes on to have now officially, even though I think and Ted Berg has made this point a few times. It should have been sooner, but now we can officially say he wanted to have a Hall of Fame career. So, you know, that to me, I had an Astros hat, an Astros bobblehead, certainly had, I think, one. There were a lot of jersey styles in, like, the late 90s that were pretty terrible.
You don't say.
So I think it was like a blue with like a white shoulder Astros Bagwell
jersey. I remember those, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the look. But, you know, that was my guy. And, you know, I always appreciated getting to observe his career as, you know, even in the way that I did. And, you know, it's crazy. He wasn't that old when he retired. But he probably still had something left in the tank if his shoulder didn't totally just
fall off, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, 2004, he's 36, 27 home runs, you know, hit pretty well overall. You know, it's not everybody does that into their mid-30s. So I think that sort of reflects how good he was. That wasn't him at the top of his game, but he was still a good player. And yeah, that's my first reaction. You got my Bagwell backstory now. So
that's a pretty high story.
Yeah. I'm very happy he's in, and I'm happy for Tim Raines finally getting in too. He had a much longer wait. And speaking of, you know, we mentioned earlier, potential podcast guests, we certainly intend to have Jonah Carey on at some point. So he should be on a victory tour.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sometime soon. So if he's, you know, if we can work it out, I'd love to have him on to delve into that. But, you know, Pudge Rodriguez deserves a mention as well. What about you in terms of the guys who made it or didn't make it? What was your first?
Well, I mean, the guys who didn't make it. So when I was a kid, I was, so a little backstory here for me. My dad is a old school New York Giants fan. So he went to the Polo Grounds with his dad to watch the Giants play. So my dad is a San Francisco Giants fan above all else. And because he grew up with the team across the country for most of his life, he's always said it's important to have an East Coast team and a West Coast team. And specifically, if you can do it from different leagues, that's the way to go. So growing up, I was a Mets fan first and foremost, but I was also a Mariners fan. And I loved Ken Griffey Jr. And, you know, Griffey's probably my favorite non-Met of all time. But right below him is Edgar Martinez. So I was really hoping that Edgar would make a bigger jump this year. But he made I think it was a 5 or 6 point jump than he did last year. And it looks like Edgar Martinez is going to be in the Hall of Fame the next couple of years. And that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, yeah, it is. You know, and I'm very much an anti-DH guy.
Mm-hmm. But that's not his fault.
No, that's exactly. You know, finish each other's sandwiches.
Yeah, exactly.
but yeah, that, you know, exactly that. It's not his fault the position existed and that he was
amazing at it.
Right. Just great at it. You know, I've seen some people point out just that the field gets a little crowded. It continues to get crowded because there's this backlog that now, you know, the Whispers guys, I would call right. them, Piazza, Bagwell, they're in, you know, Bonds and Clemens are
probably getting in.
Progress. Yeah. So you're going to have some names of guys who are going to come off the ballot because they're in the Hall of Fame. So I haven't specifically looked yet at the next class.
This isn't the Jeter year, is it? Isn't there one more year before the Jeter year?
Yeah, I think so. Right?
I think.
Or are we just old?
I don't know. We might just be old.
Did tweet as soon as it was official. The whole Bagwell thing made me feel a little bit old.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But what I was going to say was that, you know, Edgar Martinez is at the point now where almost no player has not gotten in after having that kind of support at this point in his time on the ballot.
Right.
So that makes me feel a little bit better. I'm really happy for Tim Raines. To me, Tim Raines is, and this is going to insult probably part of our audience, so I'm sorry. Tim Raines is the smart person's Jack Morris on the ballot, where there was this very loud minority that was saying that Jack Morris really deserved to be in the Hall of Fame, but everybody else kind of ignored them. And for a long time, Tim Raines was the opposite. All these really smart people were saying, no, you have to look at Tim Raines' career. He deserves the Hall of Fame. And he was just being summarily ignored. And Jack Morris did not make it into the Hall of Fame. He fell off the ballot in his last year of contention. And that didn't happen for Tim Raines. So in some ways, they're interesting parallels of each other. And I'm really glad that Tim Raines made the Hall of Fame, because him making the Hall of Fame is a sign that the voting populace is starting to look past counting stats.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. Absolutely. That's a good thing. And, you know, I'm not saying that the bar is lowered for Raines, because it absolutely wasn't. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I would probably go a little more towards the lenient side if it were up to me. Yeah, I get that you
I'm the same. I'm the same, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I get that you want it to be a distinction, but, you know, there's a point that I'm okay with a guy who might be, you know, in the bottom third of Hall of Famers, existing Hall of Famers. You know, I don't think everybody who comes along necessarily has to be, you know, inner circle.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there's just something like, all right, so as Mets fans, we've only seen two players go in with a Mets cap. And both of them, I think, I mean, Piazza had the steroid whispers, but if you take that aside, I don't think anybody's arguing that Seaver and Piazza don't belong in the Hall of Fame. But I remember as a kid when I went to the Hall of Fame for the first time, there wasn't a Met in the Hall of Fame. There wasn't a guy wearing a Mets cap in the Hall of Fame. And I think that that's got to be a bummer if you're a fan of the Tampa Bay Rays, or you're a fan of what other teams don't have. I know Griffey was the first Mariner to go in. But, you know, is there a guy in the Blue Jays cap?
Oh man, there's got to be, right?
I don't know. I don't think Molitor went in as a Blue Jay. I don't think Winfield went in as a Blue Jay. Ricky Henderson didn't go in as a Blue Jay.
Let's see.
But my point being here, I think that there is something special about a kid going to the Hall of Fame and seeing his team's cap up there. Now, that's not saying that you should let in just anybody to make that happen. But I think that, like you were saying, if there's a guy who is maybe not a slam dunk first ballot guy, I have no problem with that guy getting in on a 7th or 8th ballot. I think the baseball is a wide game. It's not a narrow game. There's lots of different parts of the game that could be honored in better ways than have been honored thus far. So I think having a DH in there, even though, like you, I'm not a DH guy, I think, you know, the DH has been in existence for long enough now, it's kind of absurd that there's not one DH in there. One guy who was, you know, predominantly a DH in there. And it's a little bit silly. So I'm for a slightly bigger haul, too.
Yeah.
Is there a Blue Jay? Did you look it up?
Of the players who... I don't know if any of them have a Blue Jays hat.
Uh-huh.
Roberto Alomar was...
Oh, he might.
A few years. That's the one guy who I think maybe. Let's see. There's got to be... This is 2017. Somebody must have posted a photo, including the Hall of Fame itself.
Right, you know, or Alomar himself.
Yes, he has a Blue Jays hat on.
Okay, so he's the one, I think.
Yeah, I think so. So yeah, that's a good point. My former Met reaction, you know, he's still on the ballot, but Billy Wagner was arguably better than Trevor Hoffman, even if you don't agree with that. I think you might agree that he was about as good as Trevor Hoffman, and Hoffman just barely missed it.
And Hoffman Wagner will be in next year, more than likely.
Right, yeah. And Wagner's, it was at about, what, 10%?
Yeah.
It's the
counting stats.
It is. And the funny thing, I mean, I know saves are the big one, but it's, you know... It's not like Hoffman pitched that much more than Wagner. And Wagner went out strong. I know Hoffman did too, but I don't know. It's weird that there's such a big disparity there.
Hoffman, for whatever reason, it has always been much more respected than the average closer.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of reasons why. I think he was an articulate guy. I think he had... amazing entrance music. I think he played for a team that he was often the highlight of. You know, there are all those reasons why, you know, Billy Wagner could be a bit gruff with the press.
Right. You know, he had some lines that maybe weren't well received in that room, but were classic lines as far as we were concerned.
Are you talking about the Lasting Smillage note?
Well, was that the same as Shocker?
No, I don't think so.
When he, you know, effing Shocker.
Yeah. No, it was Know Your Role, Rook. Wasn't that Know Your Play?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah, those were separate things. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned something that I almost forgot to bring up myself, but the entrance music. And this is where it all ties together. One of my favorite anecdotes from any closer music story I've ever heard was that Wagner was using some lame country song, I think.
Shocking. That's a fucking shocker right there.
Yeah, there you go. So it's some lame country song to come in, as far as I remember. But I definitely remember that the story was that Wagner, you know, he's doing that, and Jeff Bagwell's like, you know, their teammates in Houston at the time, and Bagwell says, "That what are you doing? That's not closer music." So Bagwell specifically recommended Enter Sandman because of, you know, the lyrics, especially the chorus, are fitting. The closer comes in at the end of the game, tries to you know, turn put the lights out on the other team.
Right, right.
You know, that sort of thing. So Bagwell is into it and gives him that suggestion, and he takes it and runs with it. And then, of course, you know, he gets to the Mets, and it's a story because, you know, Mariano Rivera does the same thing. And if I recall, Rivera's was sort of like they crowd tested a few different metal songs at Yankee Stadium, and the one that got the best reaction was the one that they stuck with for him forever. If there's a Yankees fan out there who you know, can tell me that's like a legend or a myth, please email the podcast and do so. But I believe that was the backstory of each, you know, so that's not just me trying to defend a Met and rivalry. It's assuming the Bagwell story, I think, is totally legit. And if that was the way they got it there with Rivera, you know, one of those ways was a little more natural than the other, I would say.
I'm conflicted personally on the representation of relief pitching in the Hall of Fame. Because, again, it's not necessarily the fault of the player that the manager chose to use him in the way that he was used. But right. I think that the one inning relief pitcher is, you know, infinitely less valuable than a starting pitcher or a position player.
Oh yeah, no, that's certainly true. And you know, in most cases we don't get sort of the stark contrast that we've gotten with, say, Wade Davis or Andrew Miller.
Right.
You know, most guys end up being a reliever by the time they get to the majors, or if they switch roles, a lot of times it happens very early, and then that's that. You know, and this isn't a knock on Miller and Davis. As relievers, they're among the best of their era. And, you know, their numbers in relief would compare favorably to a lot of relievers in the history of the game. But because of the way their careers developed, we know that they, you know, they just didn't work as starters.
Right.
And turned into these dominant relievers, you know. And Mariano Rivera is sort of a great example of, I guess, the point I'm trying to make here was that he came up as a starter. I think I want to see how many starts it was. I think it was 6. Let's see if my memory is as good as it was from Wilmer Flores.
arbitration numbers.
And to be clear, and we were talking about this at the Nelson Figueroa event the other night, I'm terrible at trivia when it comes to like pulling something out of my own memory. Oh, no, it wasn't 6. He made 10. He made 10 starts in 1995. We're on like a personal baseball history tour with me here. Yeah. I saw one of those.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. Didn't go so well. Generally, I don't remember specifically how his start went that day. But, you know, it's crazy to look at this. In his first year in the majors, he had a 5.51 ERA. The rest of his career, he had a 2.03. So it's crazy for as long as he played and as well as he pitched that first, you know, his career is 2.21. And, you know, there's almost 2/10 of a difference in that just from that first season. Wow. Where the starts didn't go well. So, you know, you take his numbers as a reliever and they're pretty insane. But that's sort of the point. Like, we don't get that contrast with a lot of guys, so you just see what they are as a reliever.
Right. But yeah, I think that the Hall of Fame is infinitely interesting, and it's a wonderful thing to debate. And I think if you look at the results today, while I would rather see, you know, 4 or 5 guys get in every year, just because, again, I'm a bit of a bigger Hall guy, I think you have to look at today and think the system worked, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. You know, the dream scenario for me all along was that there would be a class that was just Piazza, Bagwell, because, you know, it kind of lined up that it could work out that way if the voters had just, you know.
And see, Piazza, Griffey are my 2 favorite players of all time, And I had to work last year, that weekend. Is it the one weekend all summer I could not be around?
Yeah. Well, so. I couldn't make it up. Weddings last year and this year will mean I won't be in Cooperstown, but I will be hungover and tuning in to see what's going on. Certainly saw the Piazza speech that day, and I would like to see the Bagwell one in much in the same way.
Yeah. The reason I said that to me this definitely worked is that you get the best of all three worlds here. You got Pudge in on the first try. You got a first ballot guy who nobody would have argued with getting on there. You also get the guy who the 15 years worked for him, right? It was a guy who built up support and who really showed people that, no, this career was worth looking into and, good for him. And you also had the guy in Bagwell that deserved to be there but had, probably unnecessary steroid speculation, and that eventually lost out to logic. So to me, those are like the three things you want out of a Hall of Fame induction. You want the surefire guys to get in. You want the guys whose careers were better than you remembered them and needed some reevaluation, and you want some of the bullshit to fall by the wayside.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Rodriguez is, a really good example of that, just with Piazza being in. He probably doesn't get in right away if Piazza wasn't in already.
Yeah, you're right. I just read today something interesting about Rodriguez, and apparently he found squatting to be the most comfortable natural position he had. So, like, when he was at home not doing anything, he would just be squatting. Like, someone said they met him at the mall one time, and then he was squatting outside of the store his wife was shopping in. Because that was just, like, how he was comfortably hanging out. Yeah, which says so much about him.
It does, I like that.
Yeah. So, congratulations, folks. And hopefully by the time we speak next week, there is a resolution to the Bruce situation, though I doubt it. But there might actually be a resolution to the Flores situation. That hearing is relatively soon, isn't it?
Should have done my homework on that.
You didn't memorize that too, McShane, huh?
No. I think so. It certainly happens before spring training workouts start.
And, right, yeah.
We know that's not even that far away at this point. So, yeah, it's probably soon.
Oh, should we announce the thing?
Yes.
You want to do the honors?
I'll let you do the honors.
You know what I'm talking about?
No idea.
the ARG?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. That thing. Yes.
So February 11th at a time and location to be determined, we're going to do our Amazing Avenue regional gathering here, the ARG as it's known, in conjunction maybe with some podcast recording. We don't really know that part of it yet, but someplace in Manhattan, we'll be having a meetup with Amazing Avenue staffers as well as readers of the site, listeners of the podcast. So y'all should come out to that.
Yeah. And we know we're aiming for convenience here. Midtown isn't particularly cool in terms of bars and whatnot. And, there are plenty of places that are totally decent. But
I live in the sticks, man. Manhattan's cool to me. Midtown's cool to me.
It's it absolutely serves a purpose. So somewhere between or near Grand Central and or Penn is the goal. So keep an eye out on the site. Steve Saipa usually we may be plugging this twice. I having not heard his segment yet, we might be plugging this twice in the same episode, but that's okay. But he usually handles the official putting together of it. But it's been a good time. I've been at the past few years, missed one with an awful cold. But, assuming I avoid that getting sick in February thing, I'm very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll see you guys there, and we'll definitely catch you next week. Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Mason Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. As I mentioned earlier, please email the show, podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com. We love to get your emails. You know, they don't have to be specifically Mets related if you wanted to ask us about something else. We'd be happy to answer those every now and then. But, you know, this time of year, there's not that much to talk about. Emails do help the show stay fresh, so send us an email or two. You can also, of course, go to amazonavenue.com to check out all sorts of Mets content, including an article and some pictures about the aforementioned Nelson Figueroa charity bowling event from the other night. We're going to have an article up tomorrow about that very event. You can, of course, find Amazing Avenue also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Amazing Avenue. And please rate, review, and subscribe to the show in iTunes, in Stitcher, or download it directly from blogtalkradio.com. And finally, you can follow the three contributors for this week's show on Twitter. I am at Brian Idzunap, Chris is at Chris McShane, and Steve is at Steve Saipa. So we'll hope to see you at the ARG in a few weeks. And until then, let's go Mets!